We got to get right back on the radio. One of my favorite singers of the last, I don't know, whatever.
Of the last quite a while.
Yeah, I would say quite a while. Let's just put it this way. Chris Cornell, one of the greatest singers.
Yes.
He's got one of the sickest voices ever.
Yep.
Ever. Ever, I say.
And he writes.
And he writes?
Yeah.
What does he write?
Writes music.
What's up, Jimmy? Why you got your hood on?
No, what a guesser I just dropped in the fucking...
Oh,
a little room in there with E-Rock and Butcher.
Oh, I'm glad you bring it in here.
Poor Liam is in there, and he had to be fucking victimized, too.
Oh, shit.
Walking down the hall is Chris Cornell. How cool is
this? Yes. Look, that guy is just... He oozes rock and roll.
Yeah, he's got that.
Rock and roll.
Chris Cornell,
rock star.
Making his way into the studio.
He's a goddamn rock star.
That's what they call it.
What is it called?
A rock star. Yeah, he's a rock star.
Chris Cornell, how are you, sir?
There he is. Right.
What's going on, bro?
What's up, Chris?
Hi.
Hanging. It's Jimmy Norton.
Do you hate
Danny?
Do you hate doing this stuff?
No.
Be honest. This is my favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
to be on the radio?
Yeah, especially in the morning live. I'm not kidding. Because you can't actually do this. You can't do this job that you do unless you're good at it.
Well,
this time of day with this many listeners.
It does suck.
You'll get fired.
You're absolutely
you have to be
right.
Good at it.
You know
if
the
at
worst
least
part.
Be funny, you know.
We try.
As long as you're either smart or really funny, you can be a funny idiot. That's great.
Yeah.
Or you can be really smart. That works.
Would you ever do radio or podcasting or any of that stuff?
Not really. No.
You don't want.
I just figured some type of compelling.
Oh, mind.
You got to be kind of compelling in some way, whether it's funny or an asshole or whatever it is.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. Just something.
Exactly.
Just be something.
The hardest part of the job is getting up in the morning and coming in. Once I'm in, I'm like, all right. But when I first wake up. It's just like when I was in construction. I go like, oh, motherfucker, I can't get out of bed. This sucks.
It blows.
And then you get up and you're like, okay, now I just get to hang out and talk mouth people.
I remember my first day of kindergarten.
Really?
Like it was yesterday. And I remember, and the thing was, I remember being woken up before I wanted to be. And I remember thinking, all you guys ever want me to do is be asleep. And now you want me to get up when I don't want to.
And that starts a whole life of having to
exactly.
do that.
Exactly. And I remember it like, and I hated it. I couldn't believe it. And then they just dropped me off at this place. I don't know where it is. And there's other kids. And I didn't, that was.
Dude, how odd was that? Because
it's so not right.
I talk all the time about how I fucking was the biggest crybaby growing up. Like I would cry at the drop of a hat. And when I got dropped off at kindergarten, my mother dropped me off. And then I assumed she was just going to follow me into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there. Like, so she walks
really
me to the door. No, it was like this big thing. And I think she knew because she knew my personality at the time. So the kindergarten teacher came out and met me and grabbed my hand and starts walking. And then I look and see my mother walking the other way. I was like, I lost my mind.
She didn't warm you up to this whole
Nothing.
New experience because it goes against everything you were taught as a little fucker.
Yeah,
that you don't leave with strangers
unless you're dropped off by your parents with them
and abandoned in a strange
slavery.
Place. Yeah,
were you the kid they had to pick up like 20 minutes later?
No, I wrote it out.
You were able to ride it out.
Wrote it out.
I was the kid where I went over to my friend's house, and by the time my mom. Got back to our house, which was like a 5-minute ride. She got the phone call to come get me because
really?
I was crying like a little fucking bitch.
Couple of freaking fairies we were.
But I was 5.
I didn't have that option. Everybody was 5 when they got dropped off at kindergarten.
I know, like we were 18.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I was telling a slightly different story, so I didn't want Chris to think that I was 18.
Everyone was 5.
Well, not my. I'm trying to get my 3-year-old. To just like slowly get into it. And he's not having it. And
really?
So we would go and sort of just sit in the parking lot and watch the kids. And then he'd be kind of like, yeah, I'll go play. I'll go hang out with them. You know, he's almost 3 and a half.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that lasts about literally 4 minutes. And he's like, I want to go home. And I remember it so well. I have vivid memories of being a little kid for some reason. I have, like, a lot of the 90s, I don't remember anything. But
the
age, I remember.
There.
So I'm not really pushing him, you know. I'm like, whatever. Well, he's too young anyway. He's just getting used to the idea.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like... I hated the institution of school where they put everybody in one place. They judge them by the same criteria, make them do the same stuff. I went to Catholic school, so you have to wear the same clothes. Everything was the same. And that was like, I realized that I hated life then. I didn't know that I would end up doing the job that I do, but it's the perfect job for me.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I should be doing because I hated everything about school and everything about institutions. Mostly from the first grade. Kindergarten's cool because you did the cut and paste. There's nap time. you get to play records.
So you're pretty much writing off school after kindergarten.
By first grade, my life sucked. Kindergarten wasn't that bad. You get to bring in like your own records. Everyone brought in kids' records. I brought in the 45 of Hey Jude.
No way.
Yeah,
really?
That's my famous kindergarten story. I brought in Hey Jude, and they would not play it.
Wow.
Why?
And I didn't understand. I don't know. Maybe because it's long. Maybe because there was some screaming. Because it wasn't a little kid record.
I didn't know
exactly. I didn't know what little kid records were.
My kindergarten memories are from fucking being yelled at from Mrs. Slavic, from picking my nose and eating it, and for making other students listening to Teddy Clouser go to the bathroom. I'll be like, look, he's going to the bathroom. We'd all put our ears against the bathroom door and giggle.
You were a deviant even back then, scolded. Man.
Yeah, you were bad.
That's why kids like me hated fucking school. Tortured.
Did you make it all the way through the 12 years, or did you say
no?
At some point?
Seventh grade was the last year I finished.
Yeah,
and then I went to eighth grade, sort of a couple times.
Wait, over a couple years. How do you get away with like dropping out of school in seventh grade?
Well, I went to eighth grade and didn't finish.
But did your parents?
I left home, kind of, and then I tried eighth grade again the following year. And I was sort of started school a year early, so like psychologically, I could talk myself into it's being it's not so hard on my ego. Like right. I'm not an idiot. I started a year early, and the second attempt at eighth grade didn't go that well.
Jesus.
And
where were you living if you left home?
I was living with my grandparents, who I pretty much run the show. They they're old enough where it was pretty easy. I became like Kreskin with my grandparents. I mean, pretty much anything could appear and disappear at any time. And they're on lots of medication, so I would take like, their prescription Benadryl and take it to school and trade it for real drugs and stuff like that. I was running the show.
Yeah.
And once you get a taste of that, even if it's 13, you kind of are going to run the show after that.
The same thing happened because I went a little further. I think I went to like 11th grade and then I was fucking up so bad, mm-hmm. and the dean of boys, whatever it is, told me, look, why don't you just take the year off and come back next year and, do whatever you want to do, but come back and finish next year because you can't. He goes, there's no way you're passing this year. I go, okay. So I went out and I worked, and I'm making money. I had fucking money for cigarettes and a little whiskey in the Jack Daniels in the woods with my friends, on the weekends and
you
shit.
You get a taste of that. There's
and
no
then,
way
yeah, I went back to school, and I'm like, great, now I'm fucking broke again. I got people telling me what to do. So I just said, screw it. And
once you get a job, because that happened to me. I started working full time, I think before you're even legally supposed to.
Yeah.
And then I could pay for everything. I didn't have to take anybody's crap. And but that, obviously, at some point in my life, I wished that I would have finished school.
Yeah, don't you? It hits you at one point. You're like, I would have liked to have been a fighter pilot.
Well,
I wanted to be an astronaut.
I actually write for a living, writing song lyrics, and I can barely spell my own name. So that's been a problem.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you were kind of right to not like the institution because, I didn't graduate high school either. And it's like, not that you don't need that if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, but you've made a great living being creative.
That's true.
And despite what they would have taught you, what they would have taught you would have meant nothing.
Yeah, I think there are things about it that would have been helpful. But I'm sitting on the other side of it as a successful musician, whereas I could have easily been sitting on this side of it as a non-successful musician with no education. So it's hard enough to get a job. There are a lot of very educated people that can't get jobs now. So you don't want to be on the list of the guy that doesn't have.
You realize the element of luck that's involved also in getting to where you are. If you're lucky enough to do radio or be a musician that's successful and shit.
Yeah, it's rare.
For the most part, you're just some guy that's working a shit job because you didn't finish high school.
Let me ask you this: now that you're a parent, if your kid came to you and said, "I'm dropping out,"
I would say, "You see that tree out in the backyard? I want you to go break off the longest, thinnest branch and bring it straight to me."
You'd want him to at least try to give school a shot, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I, There are a couple of ways to look at it. One of the things is, it's a little bit like you're dean of students in a way. It's sort of like they kind of make you feel like you have to graduate in the same time frame as everybody else, and you're judged by the same criteria. I think, you know, I encourage the educational part of it, and the time frame part of it. I don't know that I would necessarily push as much. I don't think any kid really belongs two grades behind in school. But in terms of like going into college or getting more education, I don't think, you know, it has to happen within a very specific amount of time. I can go to college now.
Yeah.
No one taught me that.
Right.
I didn't know that. I thought if you don't graduate high school by 18, you're
you
going to live under a bridge
shot.
For the rest of your life. Yeah. And that's that.
You only have one shot.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Yeah.
But
there is a lot of pressure on people to graduate and get right into college.
Yeah.
Get the whole life thing started, you know, on the right track. And it is kind of bullshit because people, they progress at different speeds, so why, you know, shove somebody into college if they're not ready for it?
Exactly, and especially with the attention span part of it, because I feel like right now, at this point in my life, I could take any course and learn anything and be totally focused on it, and it's no problem. I have no distractions. I was super ADD in high school, like, you know, that's why I never really finished anything. I would just find myself staring out the window and wanting to do other stuff.
Yeah,
and then
drawing.
Over time, I kind of, that changed.
Didn't you find though that by being a dropout, like I kind of figured, like I if I don't make it, I got nothing. Like it kind of made me.
Yeah.
I left no safety net.
True.
I'm like, I either get where I'm gonna go, or yeah. I am fucking in
that
deep
is
trouble.
True. Yeah.
Did everyone in this room drop out?
Yeah, we're all fools. He's
the only one.
<That's incredible. laughs> I know. We're terrible. We're all a bunch of dropouts.
Yeah, a room full of millionaires and me.
He's got to be doing all right by now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, Jimmy's all right.
Oh God. Musically, I wanted to ask you about the James Bond theme.
Uh-huh.
Like, did you think that was just another gig or something, or was it cool to you? Like, oh, that's kind of, you know, because there have been some really good James Bond songs and some really shitty ones.
Yeah,
and it kind of does put you in the position where the song is judged.
Yeah,
separate from the movie.
It's true.
It's part of the movie.
It's true.
It's like, wow, if you put out a shitty Bond song, you're like Madonna. She put out one and it was terrible, and she caught a bunch of shit for it. But
hers,
I gotta tell you,
hers wasn't really a Bond song. I know this, the inside
right.
information.
Yep.
It was just it was like a song that didn't make her last record.
Yeah.
And so that she just changed the word, put the title of the movie into the song.
There's a sound to a good Bond song that, and it's,
right.
I can't put my finger on it, but you know it's a fucking Bond song.
Exactly.
And yours was one of the best, and I'm not just kissing your ass, it was one of the best Bond songs I ever heard. I actually downloaded it and have it on my iPod as just a fucking great song.
Cool.
Yeah. It really, like, it's a good song. Did you,
mm-hmm.
you co-wrote it?
I wrote most of it. I actually wrote an entire one, and then I was working with David Arnold, who does the score for all the Bond films. And he'd kind of wanted me to get involved with him in writing it so that musically we could use the basic melody as a recurring theme throughout the score.
Which was cool. It went through the whole movie.
You know, the melodies that I came up with, he did do that with. But I had a whole song finished and I played for him, and there are parts of it I didn't really like, and he really didn't like the same parts I didn't like. And so I thought, you know what, I'm gonna let this guy in and we'll do this together. And no one made me do it. I liked him. David Arnold's a brilliant guy. He's a genius musician. And, we just kind of finished it together. We produced it together, played all the instruments, except of course the orchestra. We didn't.
Yeah, the orchestra.
We weren't running around doing that.
We played the orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah. Oboe, right? How do you play it? Let's do this. But the funny thing is that they told me we don't want this to really sound like any other James Bond, song. And you can do anything you want, because we got this new guy, and I already knew who he was, and I'd seen part of the movie. I knew it was going to be great. And they said, so do whatever you want. And so I sort of went out of my way to try to write a song that wouldn't sound like a James Bond theme, and then it totally ended up sounding like that, which I think is really great. I got lucky. But I kind of looked at it like Live and Let Die. When I was a little kid and I heard Live and Let Die, I didn't know that it had anything to do with a movie. I just thought it was an amazing song.
It was a cool song.
It's one of the
exactly.
best Paul McCartney songs solo
you
ever.
Really do
yeah,
forget.
Yeah.
But did he write that for Bond?
Yes. Yeah. The movie Live and Let Die.
You just forget that.
Yeah. I didn't know because, you know, my parents didn't take me to the theater to see Bond movies when I was 10. So, but yeah, it was a, and the song, you know, it lived independently of the film.
Yeah.
The film lived independently of the song, but they worked together. I was an idiot, though, at first when I first got the call and they said, you know, they want you to do a song for the James Bond movie. Me being American, I didn't understand what that meant. I thought, because I have lots of songs in lots of movies where they're just kind of in there. And I thought, oh, okay, you know, that's whatever.
Sure, yeah. No, it's like, no, this is like a big thing for James Bond movies.
And I, and I didn't get it until I got on the phone and I talked to the people that you talk to and I said, I'm not going to get in a songwriting contest. I'm going to, so if you want me to do it, I'll do it. If you don't, no, but I'm not, it's not going to be, you know, you're going to wait. I'm not going to do all this work and then have you, you know, have it be part of a list of songs and then choose. You either choose me and I'll do it and I'll make sure it's great or go to hell. And they're like, no, we want you. And then I still was kind of not getting it. And then we did, then I started doing interviews and it started by phone and I was at home and they're like, so tell me, how does it feel to have been chosen to write the next James Bond? You must be 10 feet above your chair. And I'm like, wow. And I kind of had to make it up, like, sort of, you know, it's really amazing. I guess Americans don't really get this, do they? And then I did this press junket, and it was like that. People from all over the world, like, weeping about the next Bond thing.
Nice.
And then, pressure, though, man. Like, they're already saying, like, really? How amazing this is.
Oh, yeah.
Write a great one. And you're like, great works, so usually you kind of stumble on
it. It's been like Goldfinger was a song years ago that got very popular on the radio because of Goldfinger and stuff. So Bond's songs are either hit or miss. Duran Duran.
They had a huge, they were the last one that really had a big hit. And
yeah.
There
was what was
a
their
bunch
song?
Of them that, there was the one with the dance into the fire, that one. Isn't that it?
Was the spy who loved
kill.
Me?
I have,
View to
I,
a Kill. Yeah.
I get to the cars in my head. Yeah. View to a Kill was there.
They did a great job with that.
Which was another really good really Bond good. Song for the time, especially.
For
you
the
know,
time, it was a big hit. And I think that was like the last one that was like a.
That was a big one.
Hit.
You know what was good with your song was the way, and you were saying it earlier. The orchestra used it throughout the entire movie, so you'd have like a mysterious part of the movie, and you'd hear the melody of that song, but done in this very moody. Kind of thick, mysterious way. And then an action sequence would have part of the song on it, too. So
that was
to
all,
have it run through the movie like that was very cool.
And that worked out really well. And that was, you know, I hats off to David Arnold for just putting it out there because he didn't know me. And we met and he just kind of said, you know, I'd really like to work with you on this if you'd like. I know you don't have to. And you know, he didn't know who I was or what I was going to be like.
How'd you get picked? Like who? Someone?
I think it was a few people. I think a woman named Leah Volokh who does music for films. You know, she sort of finds people for the right song and the right person to do the movie. David Arnold, I think, helped.
Were they like fans that just kind of go like,
a woman named
I like
Jody Gerson, who's been worked with a publishing company of mine for years, helped. It's their job and their fans, you know. And I think the main thing was Daniel Craig got me the job because they get Daniel Craig and they've got this guy. It's like, now we're going to have this new James Bond who doesn't take any shit. And he does all his own stunts and he doesn't do anything that a human being can't do. And it's based on the first Bond book. So the first book that Bond is in. So it's sort of more of a tangible story. So now we need to get like an unapologetically male singer. That was their criteria. And then my name came up.
cool.
So I, you know, it's like, let's get a guy who's a guy and he'll sing it like a guy and he's not, and it'll be okay. And no one's going to get mad at that. And that's how I got the job.
Hey, did you submit it and go like, this is it? Or do they have a part of the creative process? Were you like, this is the song? Or they go, hey, we like it, but.
I played a demo for David and then we demoed the song together. We did a second demo. And gave it to them, and they're like, we love it, we love it, we love you, we love it. And that
That's
was
great.
It. Yeah.
And there perfect. It is. Perfect.
And they also said, you know, this doesn't usually happen this easily. And I said, well, for me, this is how I like things to go. I don't like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't like the, rewrites. I've never scrapped an album and then gone and re-recorded it, or, you know, I'll try to make sure it's, you know, what I want at the time.
One take, cut, print, perfect.
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
A man his size would have trouble writing a James Bond theme song.
I love that fucking movie.
Stupid George the Animal steel walking on the wall. Fucking Tor Johnson.
Audioslave. Now, when you're working with Audioslave, you would come into one of the other studios we were at before. We were, you know, summarily thrown out, I guess.
Kicked out of there.
As it happens.
There's less security there, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, here it's like...
You seem more important here.
Yeah, we seem more important. That's good. It's good illusion, because it certainly is not the
shit.
Certainly isn't the shit.
What happened with Audioslave? It was just time to move on.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, we don't have to get too crazy.
We did a lot. We made three albums in a really short period of time. We got to play Cuba. Our third album, I think, was kind of our best, really, in terms of, I think we finally sort of defined who we were as a band. The first couple, we were sort of, you know, going in two different directions.
That had to be rough.
And it was great. I mean, even the first album, I love the songs. I love all the records. The third album, I think, sounds the best by far. Mm-hmm. But I also think it has more of a cohesive sound in terms of the songwriting. And that was the time when, for me, I think, two things were happening. One was, there's a whole bunch of business stuff that we never really dealt with, that was really kind of tangled from the beginning, because it was two separate entities, and it was time to deal with that. We weren't really agreeing on that stuff that much. And the other thing was that we were at a stage where musically we were going to have to sort of reinvent who we were and how we did it, like Soundgarden did, going from Bad Motorfinger to Super Unknown.
Mm-hmm.
By Bad Motorfinger, we had been a band for 8 or so years. It just, no, you know, only indie people had heard of us. So that was the first album where people really heard of us, but we had defined ourselves on that album. It was time to move on. And it was difficult, you know, to reinvent your band and who you are and the way you write musically, and we did that. And I saw that as being something I'd done before, and thought, you know, if I'm going to dig that deep, I think I'd rather just sort of go back to being a solo guy.
Mm-hmm.
You guys had creative, like, artistically, it's got to be hard with a bunch of, like, because I know, was it too political for you, or not political enough, or did that get in the way?
No, we got
all?
In the very beginning, that was an issue, and we got over that pretty quickly.
Yeah, it seemed like you guys did.
Because I quit.
Before, I said, fuck that.
Before the first record came out. But no, that,
you didn't want it to be as political as it was?
Well, I didn't want to. I have no problem with somebody deciding to make that their focus of their art, but not, I'm not like that. That's just not natural for me. It would be just a stupid record. You know, I write songs like that come out. They come out when they come out, and I can't force it. It just happens or it doesn't happen.
Right. There's no agenda behind it or motive, just whatever you feel creatively as an artist.
Exactly. I mean, even on the newest record, it's produced by Timbaland. There are a couple songs on there that have sort of social political themes that just kind of came out because they did.
And you didn't go into it going, man, I'm gonna take on the establishment, man.
Yeah, and it's also, I didn't, you know, and I'm not making any judgments here or anything either, but like when you sign a record deal with Sony International, and what songs are you gonna really sing and still sort of feel like that all kind of makes sense?
Yeah. You know something? I've always thought that. It's like you're working for the man.
Yeah, and it's
who are you bashing?
It's a weird thing, and I've had that issue. That was a big Seattle problem. There was
and
it was a problem, I think, with Audioslave as well, and probably a problem with Rage Against the Machine, which Morello referred to as the punk rock guilt, which is, you know, we came from the punk rock school of things, which was anti-establishment and anti-corporate. But at some point, you're like thinking, here we are doing all of this. We're working our asses off, writing all these songs, making these records. We want as many people as we can to hear them. Why shouldn't we be Led Zeppelin? Why shouldn't we have as many people listen to our songs as them? There's no reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, like at least four bands out of Seattle have multi-platinum success, and everyone's sort of looking at each other trying to pretend like, you know, we're still, you know, in the garage, and it's not the case,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And everyone's real careful with what kind of cars they're driving, because they don't want to look, it's like, I know how much money you make, so if you're driving the Toyota, you're not fooling anybody.
You're only driving
Everybody struggled with it, and guilt.
That's,
yeah, you saw
hysterical,
it.
Man.
It came up a lot.
Because if material success or selling a lot of albums or becoming more and more famous doesn't mean that as artists you've sold out. It just means that you've connected with a lot of people and that there's a message you're giving which a lot of people like.
But
so there's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
It does change your outlook on things where when you spend all those years writing that first album, and now you're successful and have to come up with that second album. First of all, you could have been 15 when you started writing your first album.
Yeah.
And you have all this emotion and stuff, and the album's great. Now you got,
a year to
come up with the next one.
Not even a year.
Back in the day,
it was like, if you made an album and it took you 5 years and you got a record deal and they put it out, and suddenly it's the biggest thing since sliced bread, you got like 2 months.
Yeah, put out it, now do it again.
Let's go.
Wait, that was my whole life.
Yeah.
Now I got to come up with a whole new life. But again, your outlook gets different, even though you want to keep thinking the way you were thinking and stuff. Just the thing of, oh, okay, I need a corporate name. I need to make a corporation, and I gotta sign forms from a lawyer and do that. Your outlook on things change. You're not the same.
Yeah, you have to be aware of a lot more.
Yeah,
things.
you got to kind of keep an eye on things and an eye on people, and it changes your outlook.
Is it hard when you go and fuck society, and then society goes, "But we love you. Well, we think you're terrific."
For Soundgarden, that was a crisis actually for us, a legitimate one, which was we were used to having to prove ourselves everywhere we went because we were an indie band for a long time. We'd go to the club in Houston and the club in New Orleans, and you play and first in front of like the bartender and the janitor and some cross-dresser, and then the second time through it'd be about 40 people who, and some of them wouldn't have your first record, and then the third time through it would start to get kind of full, and you know, you'd go on and like that sort of slowly but surely, and it's a long process, and at some point you get this it's us against the world, and then all of a sudden you're playing a hockey arena and everyone's there to love you. We didn't really know how to deal with that.
Yeah.
We were just like us against you kind of thing. And now it's like, now you're singing our songs and you love us. And we didn't really know how to deal with that. We didn't know how to be who we were, how we had learned to be and share the love. Now I have, as a solo artist, I have the opposite thing.
You know, it's
the first Audioslave show was really weird because I remember sort of approaching Tom on stage and approaching Tim on stage and, you know, smiling and seeing like these stern sort of looks, frowns back at me, just because they'd never done that before. I wasn't part of the program.
We're not having a good time. We hate this.
It's like, why are you frowning? There's a private plane outside.
And that changed. Like, everybody loosened up and we, you know, started to have a good time. But for me now, it's kind of like I enjoy the audience likes my songs, and
you know, it's different.
Have a great time.
The different thing about Soundgarden, though, was you guys never came off as a real like bitter, angry, where every lyric of every song was about how establishment sucks and stuff. And it's like what you said before.
No,
if it came out that way, so when you had so many fans starting to just love the music, it didn't come off like, you know, oh fuck, you know, these guys are, they're world haters and shit, and it just came off as
we
great
never had
music.
A backlash of any kind.
Rage is different in that every song they wrote was, wait a minute, he's pretty much singing that he wants me dead, you know. I love the music.
I love it. Yeah. I love this band.
So that came across as almost hypocritical on their part that they embraced the corporation and the money that they were making and everything, but yet on stage
singing against
it,
all that,
it's kind of like, all right, I get it, I enjoy it, but don't try to tell me that you're really into this and, you know, tooth and nail, you're actually going down Rodeo with a shotgun. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's something that's like a monster you build and then you have to struggle with it. Like, I know only personally know about what Tom does, and Tom does spend a large part of his life giving back. He has a thing called Axis of Justice, and he's extremely involved in helping out different people from different demographics that need help from people like him because nobody else cares. And he definitely walks the walk, and I always said that about him. But at the same time, you know, you're still having to kind of be in bed with mm-hmm. with big scary companies.
You're shaking hands with certain yeah. people that you're like, yeah. ugh, I know you're a scumbag.
Yeah, and you know, I guess there's a certain amount of beauty of the fact that a large part of that industry is sort of dying off, and the scumbags don't really have a place in the world anymore, at least in the music business.
And
which is good,
yeah,
because the downloads, right? The record companies are getting cut out a lot of
digital media. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're going to see like the resurgence of mom and pop record stores because people are always going to want CDs and LPs, and all of the big stores that put those places out of business or made them struggle are going out of business
yeah.
because they can't sell the volume that they need to sell in order to stay open.
No, you watch these huge mega stores just all go down.
Yeah.
I like that point, though, mom and pop stores.
I got to disagree, though. I don't think it's going to happen. Because
nothing better than mom and pop stores, just walking around and going downstairs to the basement record store and checking out shit.
For us, because we grew up like that, but people who haven't bought a CD, like there's 17-year-olds, mm-hmm. I think 40% of them didn't buy a CD. For them, music is automatically yeah. just taken offline. They
don't
hold anything
whatsoever.
Yeah, they would yeah. have no desire to do that.
I gotta ask, because everyone's asking, Soundgarden, would you ever get the boys back together for something?
We've never really talked about doing that, so because you never do know, anything can happen.
Yeah. Does it bother you? I'm sorry, man. I was saying, I saw the Trent Reznor badmouth, and I'm like, as an artist, as a radio show, we get like, if someone, the radio show attacks us, it's like doubly fucking aggravating.
Does that happen to you?
Yes.
Really? Right. Oh, I didn't know it happened to me. I mean, I know there's radio wars, sort
Radio's
of,
a
but
circus.
You guys,
no,
it's bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They get really bad sometimes.
So really?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But it's like, we get angrier at another radio show than we would at somebody who's not, and it's like, and then Trent Reznor, who I don't know if you're friends with him or not. I always thought he was kind of a jizz bucket. That's just my take on him.
Wow.
I never really liked him.
Jizz bucket. Huh?
That's just my take on him. Fuck him. Right. Never liked him. We get it.
You never
crazy.
Liked Nine Inch Nails?
Never. But he's shitting on your new thing. It's like, for what?
Yeah, I don't know. I never met him. Soundgarden was, we were a fan of his, especially his video, but his video and had like a whole
like
song.
Yeah, yeah, it's very
I heard that.
Creepy.
I love that. We hired the same guys that did that video to do the Jesus Christ Pose video,
mm-hmm.
Based on that. And then, you know, that was kind of it for me as far as being a fan, but I liked that. I never met him. I never read what he said about my Timbaland record. Making a record with Timbaland and me being me, I knew there was going to be people who were going to talk shit. That's sort of, mm-hmm. that's like a script someone wrote for you.
It's kind of not fair because what Chris does a lot is you try to come up with new sounds and stuff. You're brave enough to try different things.
Well, I have a lot of musical influences that can't really get completely exercised in certain formats. And like on the Timbaland album, I was like huge into late 60s, early 70s R&B, funk rock, soul music. And like, I got to do a lot of that on this album that, you know, I'll never be able to do like that again. I was never really able to authentically do it before. And now I get to go take that out live. I'll always get to take that out live. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I love playing the songs live. They go over great live.
Awesome.
So for me, it's been a huge success. But like he said something that's like on Twitter, which is like you can basically put one
yeah.
paragraph.
Yeah.
And I added him so I can see what he says, you know. And he doesn't like bring it up anymore. I think he said one little thing and then it was sort of repeated over and over and over.
Sort of just like a mental kind of a, here, I'm just yeah. going to blurt this shit out and then yeah. leave it alone.
But what I do see is he does talk about Star Trek a lot. which is you know, he's got opinions about a lot of stuff, but he talks about Star Trek a lot.
Wow.
And that, I don't know what tale that tells, but it tells some kind of a tale.
A fucking nerd.
There is a group that talks about Star Trek, and maybe he gets a little preoccupied with it. And in fact, I see it on the cover of the magazine here.
Yeah.
The new Star Trek movie is out. He was talking to people about that. I think everybody's happy about it.
Five stars.
Yeah, five stars in the paper. Yeah,
you know, I don't like Trent Reznor because years ago I dated a girl named Liz who had a thing for him, and she goes, you know, he's bisexual. And she said she masturbated thinking about me and him fucking.
Jesus Christ, Jimmy.
And it always annoyed me from then. I was like,
and that was it.
Yeah, because she thought he was like really deep, and I was like, yeah.
All right, now at least we know that why.
Yeah, that's why I kind of dislike him.
As part, you brought up the videos just before. When you look back at 90s videos, did you realize at the time that they would have such a distinct look to them? Because they do. When you look back at like Nirvana videos and Nine Inch Nails videos, your guy, it had this weird, blurry, fuzzy background edge thing and old people's faces close up. Kind of.
You know why?
And they started using it in commercials for like neosinephrine.
You know why? Because it's the same guy that directed all of those videos, are the same two guys who started out as partners, and then it's those same guys that directed the commercials.
Really?
Yeah, it's the same handful of people.
I wondered, because I started seeing commercials that looked like the videos, and I'm like, that's it, these videos are done.
That's when you know you're in trouble.
Yeah, it's the same guys. It was like two guys. And I got in a big fight with one of them, because he did one of our videos, and he made it so smoky that you couldn't see who we were. And it was the first time MTV had guaranteed we were going to get heavy rotation. So it was like, okay, so we want to show people who we are. And the whole time we're filming, I'm sort of yelling like, you know, there's smoke everywhere. And he's like, no, don't worry. It won't show up on camera. And like, what do I know? I'm not a filmmaker. I don't know what's going to show up on camera and what isn't. And we get the first cut. You can't see anything, you know.
It's your Spinal Tap moment.
Yeah. And the same guy was doing that 17 minute long Metallica video with the old man's face.
Right, the old man's face.
He wouldn't clean up the edit, so we had to reshoot it. And then two months later, he sends us a new edit he does just to piss me off, where actually he did do it where you can't see any of the smoke and you can see all of our faces. And we never used that video. But I didn't like most of them anyway.
What about Black Hole Sun, which was a very
That video.
Popular one? That video is weird, really creepy if you looked at it.
That video was Howard Greenlaw, and that was us like basically saying, look, we keep trying to sort of come up with all these images and these ideas, and we can't find directors who will do it right. So let's just pick a guy that has a good idea, and we're just going to show up and pretend to play like you're supposed to, and let the guy do his thing. And that's what we did with Black Hole Sun.
That was cool because it was kind of the first real public display of morphing.
Yeah,
I think really. And
I remember him telling us, he's British, and he was like telling us, when you get the final version, it's going to be weirder than this. The first one was really weird anyway, so it didn't matter.
But then the first time I saw it, and you saw someone smile, and then their mouth got really strange, I was like, this video's scaring me.
Exactly.
Was that before Michael Jackson's Black and White?
I don't know.
And it was different. It was like, that was a morph, kind of a face-to-face change. Video. This was a face where all of a sudden the eyes would get like distorting and disturbingly big, and the nose would twist and the smile was
weird. All worked.
It's a freaky video.
Absolutely.
Man.
That's
really
another
cool
thing that I saw in commercials. To this day, I see that video being ripped off in commercials. That same sort of like over-the-top kind of post-war perfect suburbia that gets twisted into some weird perversion.
Yeah, or it's usually for some dog food commercial where the dog goes, what? And their eyes get really big because he's getting a snossage or something. that's saying
Chris has to leave.
That sucks, man.
Well, I got the flu, so I got
it's all right. We all do, too.
The swine flu.
Don't worry about it.
It's the say it's the swine flu. I don't know what that means. I ate too much pork. Too many club sandwiches.
That's nicer than the way I got it.
Well, this CD's called Scream. They're saying it's in stores now. I mean,
yeah, Chris
is just download great. The damn thing, will you?
Chris is doing Letterman this Friday. Years,
what stores? Yeah. There are no stores.
Wait, you're doing Letterman?
I did Letterman last night, but it's going to be aired Friday.
You're on with our pal Brian Regan, who was in here
comedian,
yesterday.
Yeah.
Wow, that's going to be a great Letterman. You got Chris Cornell singing, and you got Brian Regan.
Watch for the end, because he comes up, Letterman comes up behind after we're done with the song, and I don't know where he is. I can hear his voice. And I turn around and I hit his hand with the headstock of my guitar and on his knuckle. And I know what that feels like because it's obviously happened to me.
Yeah.
And I hit the shit out of his hand. and it's by accident. And he's really, he's a total pro. He's like, he did that thing where he kind of goes, ow, that kind of hurts. And you know that pause that you get when you hit your knuckle? You know it hurts, but it hasn't really kicked in yet.
It's going
to
hurt.
He goes, that kind of hurts. And then he goes up to the address the camera, and then the pain kicked in. I can see it.
And then he looks,
he kind of looked back at me over his shoulder like, you motherfucker. That you just really, it's my show, and you really just fucking cracked my knuckle.
How funny if tonight Letterman has a cast on his hand.
That would rule. He was very cool about it, but it was. Watch for that. I hope it shows up on camera.
Well, Chris, a pleasure as always. We love when you come in.
Yeah, man. I'm a huge fan of your
work. We're all
huge
fans.
Definitely.
I want to get into Mother Love Bone stuff, but next time.
Next time. Anytime you're in town, you want to promote anything or whatever, stop by, definitely.
Well, Chris, I'll be here.
Why don't we play some Chris Cornell off Scream?
Yes.
What do you want to play?
Let's see. What should
I don't even know what we have in the master computer.
What does the master computer have?
Is Iraq in there shitting himself right now? It better be in there, motherfucker.
Although a lot of people want to hear You Know My Name from...
Watch Out. Yeah. You got Watch Out.
If you got Watch Out, let's play that. It's off Scream. It's Chris Cornell.
Motherfucker.
Third solo CD.
Cool, man.
We're going to take a break. Uh-oh. They're panicking in there.
What?
Now
you got it?
You got it?
Because I heard it already.
All right, let's go.
Chris, can I get a picture?